My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Welcome back to the podcast, and welcome back to Bringing It All Back Home. We're going to have a look at one song and one song only on this episode, but we're going to do it line by line because I think this song is so, so incredible. This episode, in a slightly different form, has been previously available to Patreon subscribers when we did that, but I wanted to bring it to you because, well, it's relevant to Bringing It All Back Home for a start, and also So I just think this song, as I say, is so interesting that it kind of deserves to be taken apart line by line. Before we get to that, let's quickly say hello to some people, shall we? Oh, by the way, if you listen on Spotify, you can now ask questions to your favourite podcasters. Finally, what we've all been waiting for. This is some sort of desperate attempt from Spotify to get some sort of interaction going. But I logged on the other day and I saw we've got quite a few messages, so thank you for leaving them if you have. Hi to Tony, left a lovely message. This is about the Dylan 1973 album. This is from someone else. Doesn't actually say their name, but they say, thank you for reviewing this album and not being too harsh. It was one of the first ever Dylan albums I bought on 8-track cassette when I was a kid, and I still kind of like it. Imagine that being your introduction to Dylan. I'd never come back. I'd refuse to listen to anything else. Thank you for that. Hi to Cal, who messaged about the Friday episode. He says, how many takes were needed to get through recording without giggling? What do you mean? Why is everyone being funny about this episode? It's a great song. Hello to Carl, who says, thank you for doing Bringing It All Back Home. This is interesting. He says, I always liked this album, but it was never my favourite. However, I always thought there was a couple of weak tracks. However, going back to it now, I can see that it's an absolutely brilliant record. Thank you for going through it. Looking forward to the rest of this series. That's interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, sometimes we kind of forget that these classic albums aren't universally loved. I mean, they are kind of loved by the majority, but not universally. So that's quite interesting. So, yeah, if you are on Spotify, you can now leave a little question or a comment or whatever on the podcasts. So do that and I'll answer them here or on there. Also, hello to everyone that's bought a coffee recently. Hi to Jan in Norway. Thank you for that. Hi to Charles as well. Ian Fenwick, thank you for that. Jim, thank you. Alan, thank you again. Alex, thank you again. Hi to Richard, who's stranded in Copenhagen with the San Francisco Blues. I like it. Hi to Dylan Revisited as well. Yes, if you're on Twitter, go and follow Dylan Revisited. Brilliant little Twitter account. Hello as well to Jean Charles. Thank you for your donation. Hello to Rebecca as well. Hi to Luca too, who recently bought a couple of coffees. Nice one. You can buy a coffee, a little virtual coffee for this podcast. The link is in the episode's description as always. Let's get back to it, shall we? Let's get back to 1965's Bringing It All Back Home. And in this episode, we're going to take an in-depth look at the brilliant song, It's All Right Ma, I'm Only Bleeding.
Darkness at the break of noon, shadows, even the silver spoon, the handmade blade, the child's balloon, eclipses both the sun and moon. To understand, you know too soon, there's no sense in trying.
Dylan wrote It's Alright Ma in the summer of 1964, supposedly around the time he was working on Mr. Tambourine Man. Both songs would become centerpieces on their parent album, Bringing It All Back Home. Both songs would be some of the best and most interesting writing of his career, or anyone's career for that matter. But also, this song would sum up its context like few other pieces of art. The tune came pretty easily in the studio, which is not too surprising given Dylan had apparently taken his time with the lyrics. They were in place by the time he comes to record it. There was little rewriting going on as he cut this song. The recording happens on the 15th of January 1964. The performance is just Dylan and his acoustic guitar, so it would only take two cuts to get the song onto tape. There was a false start and then there's a complete take coming halfway through the session. It was also the session where they get Maggie's Farm and On the Road Again and a number of others done. They work from 2:30 till 5:30 in the evening with just under an hour of material recorded, which is not too bad. Just an afternoon's work, throwing some classics onto tape, fine. What emerged from that session, amongst others, was a 7.5-minute 15-verse song. It spoke for a generation. It was insanely quotable and, of course, it painted a bleak picture of existence. It's a young man's song, in that it's from a young man for a younger generation. It criticises governments and ruling classes. It asks questions of the world, and continues to do so. It also asks why, so much so, in fact, that at times the narrator questions himself. Let's take a look at it, line by line. It opens with some stunning imagery. Dylan sings, "Darkness at the break of noon, shadows, even the silver spoon." That very first line reads like it's a horror film, like something awful has happened. The world has descended into chaos, apocalypse, even death. Darkness at the Break of Noon is possibly a reference to the book Darkness at Noon by Arthur Koestler. That features a main character called Nikolai, a man in his 50s who is based on, quote, a number of men who were victims of the so-called Moscow trials. The Moscow trials were show trials, which instantly indicates what will follow in this song, a mistrust of those in power. In fact, that reference beautifully sets up the cynicism at the heart of It's All Right Ma. The opening line of Destruction is nicely paired with the second line of Shadows Even the Silver Spoon, which indicates that no one is safe from darkness or this worrying situation, not even the rich. The silver spoon is often a metaphor for the rich or prosperous parts of society, closely associated with the phrase born with a silver spoon in your mouth, as in someone has a lot of advantages because they are from a rich or influential family. So Dylan instantly paints the picture of a troubled world where no one is safe, regardless of wealth or status. This widespread darkness, the idea that no one is unaffected, is again a constant theme in the song. Next we have the handmade blade, the child's balloon, eclipses both the sun and moon. Which feels like it is slightly out of place timing-wise, like the linear telling of this story would place these lines first, the actions of mankind represented by the blade and the balloon, they eclipse the sun and moon, which, we've heard from the opener, creates darkness at the break of noon. It's like these are the reasons for that darkness. They themselves appear to represent two ends of the spectrum of life. A child's balloon is obviously gentle and fragile. Like a child itself, it's innocence and associated with happy memories like birthdays or celebrations. The homemade blade is quite the opposite and is a powerful phrase from Dylan. Rather than spend verses and verses going into detail, he has to use just one word to tell us everything that we need to know here. If he'd said a blade and a child's balloon, it wouldn't quite be the same. But a homemade blade suggests a sinister edge to it. Homemade implies a secrecy, a crude, violent edge to it all, like a rage has been festering unchecked at home. This juxtaposition again confirms the earlier line of Silver Spoon in that everyone is affected in this world, from the innocent to the other end of things. The world's wrongs, or the system's wrongs, gets everyone in the end. As to what those wrongs actually are, well, we'll get to that soon. The closing lines of verse 1 signify our narrator is unable to improve his situation. Dylan sings, "To understand you know too soon, there is no sense in trying." On the second verse, we're presented with something else that occurs during the song, an apparent attack on the people in power. It's All Right Ma, after all, is a proper counterculture song, a protest song, we can even call it. In my mind, Dylan didn't actually make too many of these, really. Some of his songs have been lumped into that category because he was big in the 60s and he wasn't a conservative artist, so people naturally called him part of the counterculture, and he was. But here on this song, he's making no bones about it. I believe this is a song for the different thinkers of the 60s. In fact, if you're going to pick any of Dylan's songs for that movement, this is probably your best bet. The verse starts with pointed threats, they bluff with scorn. Suicide remarks are torn. From the fool's gold mouthpiece, the hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn. We hear of people or a group of people who talk with fool's gold mouthpieces. The very nature of fool's gold, a fake gold, a faux gold, if you will, indicates that these people are supposedly rich or rich in power or position, but it's all a lie. Fool's gold resembles gold to the untrained eye, but it's actually worthless in comparison. So Dylan is saying the same for the leaders of the time. He's talking of their desire to get the general public to conform so they can control and use the masses for their own gain. But they themselves aren't talking from any particular point of wisdom. Every step of the way, Dylan undermines them. Hollow horns, a futile sounds, bluff with scorn. This is suggesting it's all bravado, all aggression to cover up a lack of substance from these people. They talk with wasted words. Also, pointed threats bluffed with scorn gives them an overly aggressive air. Dylan's saying they are overly aggressive to try and scare, to control with fear, but he can see through it. This all builds to a critical line. He not busy being born is busy dying. Which is now a famous line and a beautiful end to that verse. It's talking about progression. Dylan loves to talk of inventing and creating yourself. He even enjoys themes like transfiguration, the idea that you can become someone else. Sometimes he even claims literally. Here, I think he touches on that, but perhaps in simpler terms. You either evolve or you die. You either move with the world or it leaves you behind. If you're not opening your eyes and looking around you, you are sleepwalking through life. This is talking about the new generation of thinking. It's their time now. The old guard with the fool's gold mouthpieces are going to lose their place in society as this evolution takes place. But it's not as easy as just holding your nerve and being on the right side of things. The world will test you in different ways, as Dylan outlines in the third verse. He sings, "Temptation's page flies out the door. You follow, find yourself at war." Which, not for the first time, puts us in Bible territory. There is a temptation to buy into this myth peddled by the fool's gold mouths, to be coerced into their control, or, as we'll see later, seduced by it. But this aimless following won't do you any good. Soon enough, you'll hate yourself. You'll be at war with yourself. Dylan continues, "Watch waterfalls of pity roar," which is a great line. It's also kind of celebrating the beauty of that pity, but in a slightly hateful, self-critical way, a dismissive way, almost. The next lines continue this too. "You feel to moan, but unlike before, you discover that you'd just be one more person crying." Also note that crying rhymes with dying. In fact, those two syllables of crying and dying becomes the sound of the people who are following the rules without any question, the people that are following the fool's gold mouthpieces. They, like the sounds of those words, are decaying. It goes down at the end, dying and crying. Whereas by the time we get to the first chorus, there is a little more hope and the language reflects that. Dylan sings, "So don't fear if you hear a foreign sound in your ear." Fear, hear, and ear are all much more punchy. They have a much sunnier disposition. He finishes the chorus with a kind of glib joke in the form of, "It's all right, Ma, I'm only sighing." This is like Dylan is saying, "It's all right, Ma, I'm only singing about the state of the world, and that really means nothing." The sort of joke which fits into the tone of the song perfectly. I've always felt the line "foreign sound in your ear" is Dylan's description of a new way of thinking. But with the final line, he's under no illusions that this is a fool's errand. And as we'll see, he even suspects he shouldn't be speaking these words or ideas at all. Like we've seen previously, there's a contradiction in the next verse. It seems to indicate a war, too. It opens with, "And some won victory, some downfall." Worn is a word that is used elsewhere. It's used when Dylan describes the fool's gold mouthpieces and how their actions should warn us that we should be busy being born rather than dying. Here he uses it again, so we can assume that he is referencing the same people talking of victory. The Cuban Missile Crisis had only appeared a couple of years previously, and the Cold War was already in motion by this point too. Also, the Vietnam War was gaining momentum in the US as well. In the August of the summer that Dylan writes the song, President Johnson calls for airstrikes on North Vietnamese patrol boat bases. Two US aircraft are shot down and one US pilot becomes the first US airman to be taken prisoner in North Vietnam. The first ground troops would arrive in March 65. The sense of America and its place in the world was being championed by some and criticised by others. There's a feeling of totalitarianism in those lines, which is continued to a degree as Dylan sings, "Private reasons, great or small, can be found in the eyes of those that call to make all that should be killed to crawl." Private reasons has another sinister edge to it, as does making all those who should be killed crawl. There's a punishment to that line. If this is referencing war, cold or otherwise, then it doesn't seem like a fair war, if that's possible. While humans are always consigned to die in war, here they appear to be crawling before it, like they're being punished, tortured even, played with or toyed with. There is much more going on here than just war. People are not just being killed. Dylan is quick to point out that there may be ulterior motives in America's foreign policy. The grim violence is continued on to the next verse as Dylan sings, "Disillusioned words like bullets bark as human gods aim for their mark. Make everything from toy guns that spark to flesh-coloured Christs that glow in the dark." Disillusioned words feels like the sort of phrase that would describe scaremongering. They, as we've seen from this era of politics, can leave a mark, like bullets. Disillusioned words would grind down the masses, stop them from opening their eyes, or seeing joy, or finding a different voice. Human gods suggests that we are hearing about leaders or people in power. They have all the luxuries of the gods, all their power, but they are here on earth. They're human. In the second line of this verse, we have those human gods aiming their very real guns. But in the next, it's juxtaposed with toy guns. This acts as an additional criticism of society. How we freely use guns to win wars, but yet we sell the same items to our children, wondering as we do why nothing changes. This sort of idea is continued right up to the end of the verse, with those glow-in-the-dark Christs. The idea that religion, belief, or even faith is reduced to a gimmicky commodity, or even that faith itself is no longer sacred, tainted even. Dylan completes this by wrapping up the very points I've just mentioned with, "It's easy to see without looking too far, that not much is really sacred."
Disillusioned words like bullets bark as human gods aim for their mark. Make everything from toy guns that spark to flesh-colored Christs that glow in the dark. It's easy to see without looking too far that not much is really sacred.
So far we've had a dig at people in power and commercialization too. But as we'll come to see, no one escapes Dylan's wrath. Next up, he takes a shot at the church. He sings, "While preachers preach of evil fates," which feels like a sarcastic dig at the church, often suspected as a suppression tool for the masses. The idea that sin is a tool used for controlling. Because he mentions nothing but evil fates when he mentions preachers, we can assume that Dylan isn't mentioning them in a positive light here. What follows is another sarcastic dig, and once again, it's at society. In the next line, Dylan takes on the myth that you can get anywhere on a good education, which may or may not be true, or may not be false. But in this world, in the song's world of paranoid disillusionment where everything is controlled, it is a fact. Dylan sings, "Teachers teach that knowledge waits can lead to $100 plates." This, for me, feels like it's a suggestion that people of the world are living in this world under a lie. Knowledge can lead to wealth and status. At least that's what they are told. That's what they are taught. If you wait your turn and learn your lessons, then you'll get to where you want to be. As I say, in the world of this song, that isn't true. If you're not in the club, if you're not part of the ruling classes, then no matter how much education you have, it won't help you. Next in the song, Bob goes for the jugular. The president. The president is mentioned a couple of times in this era. Dylan seems to have him on his mind, but here it seems a little general. He sings, "Goodness hides behind its gates, but even the president of the United States sometimes must have to stand naked." Here the goodness seems locked away, hiding, or is that just another thing we are told? Perhaps this is a reference to the White House and the perception that the president has our best interests at heart. He is working for us. But ultimately, in this song, that is not true. The president is bluffing, he's posturing. Eventually, though, he will be found out. As Dylan says, even the president has to stand naked sometimes. That line is a solid reference to the idiom "the emperor has no clothes," or even the story of the emperor's new clothes. This is a common used expression which describes a situation in which people are afraid to criticise something or someone because the perceived wisdom of the masses is that thing or person is good or important. I know it from the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, but it apparently originates from an anthology of fables from 1052 that tells the story of a dishonest merchant who swindles the king by pretending to weave a supernatural garment that cannot be seen or touched by any person of illegitimate birth. Regardless, the line does a good job of summing up what we've heard over the previous verses. The world is corrupt, and so are most of the people in it. From here, we move to the song's second chorus. It once again has a hint of conspiracy about it, but not in a tin foil hat way. There is a desire to criticise an abuse of power in this song. The first two lines suggest we live by laws, but they can be bent or manipulated. It's the people you have to worry about, not the laws in place. Dylan sings, "Although the rules of the road have been lodged, it's only people's games that you've got to dodge. And it's all right, Ma, I can make it." That final line, like we saw in the first chorus, has a more positive suggestion to it. But once again, it could be read as a sort of joke, like it is elsewhere. In fact, the title of the song alone sort of suggests this to us. "It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding" isn't literal, nor does it feel like we have a proper metaphor saying "it's okay, this is just a scratch," or "it's okay, this is really nothing." For me, it's a joke along the lines of "it's okay, I'm only bleeding to death. The world is only taking everything from me, piece by piece." And so, with this joke hanging over the choruses and the verse's twitchy indignation, it all becomes desperate and sad, filled with black humour. Next, Dylan turns his anger to advertising, although it's not really advertising, more commercialism. More the way the world works, with capitalism, anyway. He sings, "Advertising signs, they con you into thinking you're the one that can do what's never been done, that can win what's never been won. Meantime, life outside goes on, all around you." This verse feels like it could only be a product of the 60s and the counterculture. It's pure counterculture fodder, in fact. And while, as I've mentioned, I feel Dylan actually didn't really sing about this stuff as much as people think he did or does, here he's really going for it. The verse, though, is wonderfully concise. The actual message behind it has been trotted out a million times since and quite a few times before. But for me, the skill here is not really in what Dylan is saying. It's nothing earth-shattering. He's pointing out thoughts that lots of people his age would have had at the time. But the way he delivers it is incredible. It's quite the skill to sum up the feeling of Western commercialization in just six lines. He does it here in what would take others 60 pages. The "that can win what's never been won" line reminds me of Dylan's earlier work. Take Masters of War, for example, that has the line, "A world war can be won, you want me to believe." In the following verses, we briefly shake the heavy tone of the song. It starts with, "You lose yourself, you reappear," which is where the song takes a turning for me. We're about halfway through it here, and as we move from scenes of temptation, darkness and war, we come to a little bit more defiance from our narrator. This happens as Dylan outlines some action. He sings, "You suddenly find you've got nothing to fear. Alone you stand with nobody near. When a trembling distant voice unclear startles your sleeping ears to hear that somebody thinks they really found you." That distant voice could be a recall of the foreign sound in your ear from the previous chorus. This sounds like an awaking of sorts. The sleeping ears are awoken by some sort of revelation. We're not privy to what has actually brought on this sudden change, but Dylan's obsession with invention and even transfiguration, the idea that you become someone else, discussed a few times in his interviews, might be starting here. Our narrator is finding new thoughts and new ideas, changing his views, and he's becoming engaged. Whatever has sparked this has Dylan convinced. He continues, as he has done for the second half of the song so far, Awoken. He sings, "A question in your nerves is lit. You know that there is no answer fit to satisfy. Ensure you not quit, to keep it in your mind and not forget." We then reach another key line of the song, which is that it is not he or she or them or it that you belong to. This is another very counter-culturey line. It's an obvious attempt to call for a new way of thinking. You don't have to belong to the old systems, the patriarchy or the former gatekeepers. Dylan himself casts them off in the following chorus of, "But though the masters make the rules for the wise men and the fools, I've got nothing, Ma, to live up to." Masters, again, could be a nice little link back to Masters of War. But Dylan is saying he really has no one to spearhead his new campaign. He mentioned earlier about having no answer, and that seems to be continued here because neither the wise men nor the fools are on his side. He is very much, again, as he said earlier, alone. While Dylan has outlined the feeling of this new generation, and by that I'm not saying this is an age war particularly, more a generation in terms of thinking, not defined by their age and birthday numbers, more their frame of mind and how they approach life. He's also outlined the wrongs of those in power. And now he speaks of the sleepy population who are all numbed by the tricks of the state, outlined in those lines of advertisers and preachers. The lines are, "For them that must obey authority, that they do not respect in any degree." Dylan then takes the time to focus on the division in society, the dying and the busy being born, shall we say. The two opposing forces of people. He sings, "Who despise their jobs, their destiny, speak of jealousy of them that are free. Do what they do just to be nothing more than something they invest in." The "nothing more than something they invest in" line could be pointing out that the majority of people in this society follow the rules. They go to work, they invest their money in themselves, and that's all there is to life. But it also could be read differently. The "they" could be the man, for want of a better phrase, looking at people as a commodity, something like a stock that they can invest in, that they can use to get rich, that can be manipulated. The next lines continue down this slightly dystopian feel, as Bob sings, "While some on principles baptized to strict party platform lies." He's basically saying this is all a con. This fits in with the earlier disillusionment in the song and suggests that the public follow political parties blindly, even if they don't particularly deliver. "Don't follow leaders" is what Dylan has sang elsewhere on this song's parent LP. But here perhaps he's going a little deeper, saying that this is long-running, entrenched. It's a problem that has been present for years, decades, millennia even. The use of "baptized" makes it feel like this has been going on since the very start of life itself. They're creating an environment where new thoughts and ideas cannot be expressed. "We are fed this stuff and you're born into that way of thinking." This is outlined and continued in the next lines of, "Outsiders, they can freely criticize." The people aren't allowed much, but they are allowed to criticise outsiders or people that don't think like they do. The line before about a social club in drag continues that feeling of lies and misdirection being spoon-fed to the masses. We then finish with the line, "Tell nothing except who to idolise and say, God bless him." They can't criticise the idols that they are told to follow, unlike the outsiders. The use of God here puts us in mind once again of those preachers we heard about before, but also another song from a previous Dylan LP, "With God on Our Side." The idea that blind faith, that feeling that you are in the right with your opinions and can justify your actions, even hideous ones, because, well, God is on your side. It's all okay. You are allowed to get away with it. Next up, Dylan sings, "While one who sings with his tongue on fire," which again feels like it could be biblical. The phrase tongue on fire has a very biblical feeling to it. And yes, it is in the Bible a few times. There is a passage that deals with Pentecost, a celebration which comes from a Jewish harvest. The apostles were celebrating this festival when the Holy Spirit descended on them after Christ's resurrection. The people passing by at first thought they must be drunk, but the apostle Peter told the crowd that the apostles were full of the Holy Spirit. It had come to them in the form of tongues on fire. However, I can't help but feel it's more linked with another passage, James 3:6, which reads, "And the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell." This is talking of an unrighteous tongue that then infects the whole body, tainting it. Similarly, there's a passage in Proverbs 16:27 that reads, "A worthless man digs up evil, and his speech is like scorching fire." Both these feel similar to what is happening in "It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding." The rest of the verse is Bob continuing in detail about this unrighteous person. He sings, "He gargles in the rat race choir," which for me is a great line. The rat race puts us in the mind of the working commuters in a big city heading to their commercial jobs. Perhaps they're the same ad men and women from before that Bob scornfully addressed in verse 7. The idea of them gargling is, again, a nice touch. They're not speaking, they're just murmuring rubbish. This implies that they cannot even form proper words for themselves. They are told what to say. They can't think for themselves. Dylan concludes this with "bent out of shape by society's pliers." This is not their fault. Society has run them down. Pliers is a nice touch as well. It has a horrible feeling to it, that word. These people aren't being hammered, which is a blunt, aggressive act. Pliers implies it is manipulative. They are sharp and sometimes linked to torture. It also, of course, rhymes with choir. In fact, that might be the reason that pliers is included. We then get Dylan telling us that these people will drag you down to their level. He does this with the lines, "cares not to come up any higher, but rather get you down in the hole that he's in." The line, "cares not to come up," suggests that this person is not just bent out of shape by society, but they are so broken by it, they're so embittered and no longer want anyone to be happy or free. Dylan takes pity on this person. In the chorus he sings, "but I mean no harm nor put fault on anyone that lives in a vault. But it's all right, Ma, if I can't please him." Vault is a good choice of word here. It's a good choice for the population that is complying with society's wrongs. Vaults are inescapable, all-controlling, and very few have access to them, usually only the rich or powerful. It also brings me back to that earlier line of nothing more than something they invest in. People in a vault reminds us that they are a commodity. They can be used and manipulated for others' gain. They are important, precious, something you would want to hold in a vault. Dylan's camp, though, is responsible. They don't want division in this society. There's no harm nor put fault. After all, one of the buzz phrases of the time was "make love, not war." This is along a similar line for me, even if Dylan can't really be coupled in with that hippie crowd particularly. The final part of the song is pretty disenchanted and sour. It starts with the lines, "old lady judges watch people in pairs, limited in sex, they dare to push fake morals, insult and stare." This line is a little more transparent about the divide in age and generations. Here, a member of the authorities, one of the highest members, the lady judge, is lecturing young couples on their sexual morals. But she herself is limited in this area and doesn't even believe her own thoughts anyway. Dylan reveals that she is pushing her fake morals. She is just going by what society tells her to do. It's interesting that Dylan makes her an older woman as well. It's sad to say that while attitudes are changing, there is still a stereotype of older women and sexuality. In fact, a friend of mine even recently wrote a paper titled Challenging Prevailing Attitudes About the Supposed Asexuality of Older Women. This was, like most social issues, even more prevalent in the 60s. And so, with Dylan making her an older woman, something that is often not sexualized in our media at all, it makes her limited sex stand out even more against these young sexualized couples. Of course, this is not really about sex at all. It's more a metaphor on how the ruling classes tell young or free or forward-thinking people how to live their life. They should live their life this way because, well, these are the rules that have been here forever. Next, we have one of the song's most famous lines. In fact, it's one of Dylan's most famous lines. He sings, "While money doesn't talk, it swears."
Old lady judges watch people in pairs, limited in sex they dare, to push fake morals, insult and stare. While money doesn't talk, it swears. Obscenity, who really cares? Propaganda, all is phony.
Which is another one of those lines that sums up the entire song. As we know, money talks is a well-used idiom. It means money can get you what you want. It transverses morals or laws. It can gain power. Here's a brief and, dare I say it, unneeded history lesson in the idiom. It comes from the Greek dramatist Euripides. He was alive in the 5th century BC. He apparently wrote some 95 plays in his working life, gaining him a high enough reputation to be talked about in the same sentences as Dylan's old friend, Homer. 2,000 years later, and the book Adagia was published. It was the title of an annotated collection of Greek and Latin proverbs, compiled during the Renaissance by a Dutch dramatist. In the translation is where we have the first English record of the quote, "the talking power of money." The precise current phrasing of "money talks," however, only began to be used widely in 1900. Yes, I did slip down a Google black hole to deliver that slightly pointless history lesson. The phrase "money talks" alone is perfect for this song, though. It really is getting at, once again, the core of the tune's meaning. However, in this song, Dylan likes to ramp the ante up a little. This song is born out of a time when change was afoot, but it was aggressive change. Don't forget, things like the very real feeling of nuclear conflict is still present at this point in history. I mean, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, or CND, was only formed in 1958, and their symbol was being adopted by the youth movement around this time. This all informs the song's underlying aggression. So Dylan ends up using a phrase like "money swears" rather than "money talks," because in this context, everything is heightened. Society has gone beyond its well-known problems. Things are getting to a fever pitch now. But again, as it does, our narrator seems to be trampled by them. As that earlier forthrightness seems to slowly fade away, we hear Bob sing, "Obscenity, who really cares? Propaganda, all is phony." That line always reminds me of The Catcher in the Rye and the lead character's use of the word "phony," which is a recurring moment in the book. I've seen a few pieces online that have identified this too, but it is apparently a red herring. In March 66, Dylan spoke to Playboy. They asked, "Did you read Catcher in the Rye as a kid?" He says, "I must have, you know. Yeah, I think so." And they asked him if he identified with Holden Caulfield, the lead character. Dylan replies with, "What was his story?" Playboy then says he was a lonely kid in a prep school who ran away and decided that everyone else was phony and that he was sensitive. Dylan says, "Yeah, I must have identified with him." So maybe Dylan isn't explicitly referencing Catcher in the Rye, but unconsciously or not, he seems to share some DNA with it in this song. Although this is a Dylan interview, something we can rarely trust. In the penultimate verse, Bob slips further into darkness. He starts with, "While them that defend what they cannot see, with a killer's pride, security." This line, like a lot of this song, feels chillingly relevant to today's world. In the middle of alternative facts and Facebook theories and Twitter echo chambers, these lyrics could have been easily penned by Bob on his COVID-19 concept album. Not that we'd ever want that, or he'd ever do it, of course. But this is a sign of good writing, good poetry, hell, even good philosophy. And that's what this song is. It is philosophy. It's a take on the world, our society's wrongs, the myth of capitalism and consumerism, but it's also a take on humanism. While, yes, the song does deal with power and its misuse, money and its misuse, and things like advertising and religion and how they play into that, the song is also discussing human nature. While them that defend what they cannot see with killer's pride security, is that forthright blind faith without any facts? Whether this be religion, again harking back to the with God on our side notion, or perhaps even things like war. Most of us don't actually experience things like war firsthand. We cannot see them metaphorically or physically. Yet we have an opinion on it. Sometimes this happens with an extreme opinion, especially in that fever pitch context I mentioned before. Dylan outlines this as a killer's pride, which comes with a, as he puts it, security. Killer's pride perhaps hints that this is to do with a war, but also indicates that it's bold, aggressive, and even psychotic. Like people will stop at nothing to put their point of view across or force it on other people. These people believe in this thing that they are willing to defend it until death, perhaps because it brings them security. The old myth of controlling the masses, making them feel safe in society if they buy into it. But this is all a lie from Dylan's point of view, as he outlines in the next lines of, "It blows the minds most bitterly for them that think death's honesty won't fall upon them naturally." The idea that we all die eventually and we all end up in the same way, again, is going against a lot of what Dylan is criticising in the song. Religion, advertising, they both offer a happier thought than what Dylan describes here as death's honesty. It also, for me, feels paired with the Naked President line, "This world gets you in the end, no matter who you are." Also, interestingly, Bob hardly calls anything honest in the song at all, but here, death is bestowed that title, quite fittingly. He finishes with the line, "Life sometimes must get lonely," which not only speaks for those that die, you come into this world alone and you leave it alone, but also for our narrator. As we'll see, he can't escape. He's very much on his own. Before we get to that, though, there's a final verse. It, like elsewhere on Bringing It All Back Home, dips its toe into the psychedelic, without exploring too much. It also marks our narrator becoming completely disenfranchised. Dylan sings, "My eyes collide head on with stuffed graveyard false goals I scuff." Here he's literally brushing up against the very things he's been criticising in the song, most notably false goals, which could easily be read as goals set in religion, or goals set by commercialisation, or goals set by presidents, or those adverts he was seeing. Take your pick from anything he's criticised in the song. He continues singing, "At pettiness which plays so rough," which is another line that I really like, and I've always liked. Pettiness itself is a little pathetic thing. Its definition is undue concern with trivial matters. We're sweating the small, insignificant stuff here, but as Dylan says, it plays so rough, telling us that pathetic little things can sometimes drag us down. Spiteful little disagreements can take up our time away from what really matters, or even can distract us from what else might be going on. He continues with, "Walk upside down inside handcuffs, kick my legs to crash it off, say, okay, I've had enough, what else can you show me?" Here, our narrator wants out, he's done, he's fed up with it, he's so sick of it all, he's asking what's next. It's like he's lost his mind, shouting, "What else can you show me?" to the sky, which would be a defiant ending if we didn't have a final chorus. In it, Dylan sings, "And if my thought dreams could be seen, they'd probably put my head in a guillotine. But it's all right, Ma, it's life, and life only."
Our narrator feels he is too radical to be accepted by the powers of society or society itself. They no doubt will kill him if he speaks of their oppression or his alternative way of thinking. Dylan has always been out of step with society, and here is confirmation of that. As a side note, I love the use of guillotine. It's once again perfect for this song due to its association with the French Revolution. The lines, though, are of course the punchline of a joke. Dylan has spent a full 15 verses or so talking of his differing thoughts, his alternative way of thinking removed from the norm, for him to then say, "Oh, but I could never talk about these things. They'd kill me. They'd put my head in a guillotine." I don't know, Bob. I think it might be a little bit too late for that. There's one final joke too, and it's the recurring one I've mentioned before. The line is, "It's life and life only," which suggests that life itself has become, like everything else, phony. Sure, people as a commodity are profitable to society, but life itself, actually someone dying, not so much really in the grand scheme of things. With All Right Ma, Dylan gave a breathtaking voice to a generation of new thinkers. Bob wasn't quite as idealistic as he's often painted out to be, but here I think he is. He's singing about things at the core of not only our society, but our humanity. Things that need to be questioned and analysed. A good artist creates art, but a great artist questions. And here Bob not only creates a piece of stunning musical art, but opens a debate and a conversation. The song itself, on its own, even opens your eyes. There's very few occasions when someone can so vividly capture a moment in culture as Dylan does in this era of his work, particularly here. This isn't a song. It's a cultural document.
And if my thought dreams could be seen, they'd probably put my head in a guillotine. But it's all right, Ma. It's life and life only.
That is it for this episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. Just one more episode to go on this album now. I'm not ready to say goodbye to it. It's such a good record. Before we get to that, we are going to look at Knocked Out Loaded. Not quite as good a record. We'll have a look at that next time. Do you know what, though? There is one saving grace to that album, isn't there? And I think for that reason, it's good that it is in our lives, even though it's not a great listen, it has to be said, the rest of the album. So we'll get to Knocked Out Loaded next time. I will see you then for that. In the meantime, take care.